Done on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Earl Scruggs died last week. One of our guests, Peter Cooper, writes in a beautiful tribute in the Daily Tennessean. Earl Scruggs was 88 years old. He lived an unmitigated triumph of a life, enabling the creation of the great American music form known as bluegrass and ennobling his instrument of choice, the banjo. Peter went to Sunday's memorial service, and he says that it made clear this man's import and impact. He was the last of bluegrass music's original architects. He was the most forward-thinking and genre-busting of those architects. They cheered at his memorial service. Why? Peter says, I think they cheered for the banjo man's victorious career. And cheered because future generations of players and fans will always have the "where were you when it happened" experience of hearing him for the first time. I think they know that the music lives on, and I think they cried because Earl is gone.
I was born in 24, and I've been playing from since I was 4 or 5 years old, or trying to play. And 45, I thought it was time to start making music my career, because that's all I thought about. That's what I wanted to do. So I, Bill heard me and he wanted me to go to work in his band. So that's the way I got started.
The life of Earl Scruggs this hour of the program, and we have two great guests with us. Peter Cooper is a senior music writer for the Daily Tennessean, and he is a Grammy-nominated singer and songwriter. Peter, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you for having me.
And Bob Black, bluegrass musician and banjo player. He toured with Bill Monroe and is the author of Come Hither to Go Yonder, Playing Bluegrass with Bill Monroe. Bob, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We just played a little bit of an interview, but you can hear in just those few sentences what has been described as this helpful and humble banjo player. It's wonderful just to hear those words and to hear him speak, isn't it, Peter?
Oh, yeah. He was a great conversationalist, and he was one of those people who always thought before he spoke. He would tell you what he thought, but not until he had decided that was really what he thought. A very considered man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was it that was totally unique about the way that he played the banjo, Bob?
Put the notes together in a steady, melodic, kind of a flowing sequence, kind of similar to the way old fiddle tunes would go. Before Earl came along, there were banjo players that would do three-finger rolls for a short amount of time, but it was real kind of choppy, you know, and they would have rhythmic sections where they were backing up their singing or whatever. But Earl actually brought out this style that was flowing all the time, and that was there wasn't really anybody doing that.
Mm-hmm. So did he make all of us notice the banjo? Did he make that instrument front and center in some way?
Oh yes, definitely. That was the thing that drew me to bluegrass music in the first place was the banjo playing, and Earl Scruggs' banjo playing was the one that was the person that caused me to decide I wanted to play the banjo. And so, you know, like I've been telling people, Earl is the reason why I've never gotten a real job. I've always been a banjo player.
Yeah, and Bob's not alone in that. You know, I've seen over the past week so many banjo players talking about the first moment that they heard Earl play.
Really?
And how that was as impactful as, you know, it was a, as I said in that article, a "where were you when it happened" moment for them. And whether that's J.D. Crow or Bela Fleck, and I'm sure Bob probably recalls the first time he heard it. You know, everyone who's picked up a banjo since December of 1945 has done so in part because of Earl. I mean, the way that everyone plays is impacted by that. There's no instrument that is so defined by one person as the banjo is, and not that there haven't been wonderful innovations to come since then, but you're building on Earl when you pick that instrument up.
Mm-hmm. And there's no instrument that so defines bluegrass music as the banjo does. Do you think?
I would say probably not. You know, Bill Monroe, who was the father of bluegrass music, you know, he played mandolin, and his style of mandolin was based on fiddle music. But then you think about Earl Scruggs' banjo playing, that's what really brought it out, you know, and really popularized it. Actually, Earl's banjo music is sort of based on fiddle music, too, though, so it really harks back to the old fiddle tunes, basically. But the banjo is what definitely brought the popularity of bluegrass out, in my opinion.
I always like to hear the stories of how people do what they do, how they get a break, what forms them early in their lives to have them consider a certain career. Why was it the banjo? What were the influences? What is it, his musical dad and mom, Peter? Tell me about his early life.
Well, his father died when he was young, and he had a lonely childhood in a lot of ways. And he was raised in North Carolina, kind of near the town of Shelby, which is near, I guess, Spartanburg, South Carolina would be the metropolis in that area. He used to listen to music on WSPA radio out of Spartanburg, and he would hear some folks doing a three-fingered style of banjo playing that was prevalent in his area. So he was listening to the radio a lot, and he was spending a lot of lonely hours with his banjo just out in the field playing to himself. And so there was a lot of practice time, and there was in the air that you could hear other people using three fingers as opposed to two with the banjo. So he developed his style really on his own. There was no, of course, there's now you get instructional books on how to do that based on the way that Earl did it.
Right.
But he was coming up with it on his own in lonely hours, and he had a banjo. I believe it was his father's, the first banjo he was playing, and so it was around, and he just it caught his fancy.
Mm-hmm. And he was playing dances in North Carolina and local radio programs, but he got a break where?
Well, his break came in Nashville when he went there with a guy named Lost John Miller. But yes, he was playing some dances around North Carolina and in Tennessee with Lost John. He was working at the Lily Thread Mill in Shelby, North Carolina, and told me that he realized that he was onto something, because he and another fellow would play during supper break. They'd have a half hour, 45 minutes or whatever, and they would spend it out in the parking lot. They'd kind of sit at this car and play, and the other workers would gather around. And he said that there was one fellow who was working there at the thread mill who got so excited when he heard Earl playing that he took his hat off and he threw it on the ground and he stomped on it. Earl said, that's hard on a hat. So he was. It was this delightful, just kind of a party trick that surprised everyone who heard it. And then his break. Maybe Bob should best tell the story of him being introduced to Mr. Monroe and getting that break there.
Okay.
Well, they should have thrown money in that hat.
There wasn't much hat left to throw money into at that point. And there wasn't much money around at the Lily Thread Mill.
I'm sure there wasn't. And how did he meet Mr. Monroe?
I understand that he auditioned for the job, although, you know, Peter's more historically up on this stuff, but it was in 1945.
Yeah, and it was a hotel audition.
He didn't, so he didn't audition like at the Opry or something.
Well, I think there was, I'm a little fuzzy on the details. Essentially, Monroe was needing a banjo player, but at the same time was a little frustrated by the limitations that seemed inherent in that instrument. And there were great banjo players that came before Earl, but they played in a style that didn't quite mesh with what was in Mr. Monroe's head. And it was not anything that was being called bluegrass, but there were others who brought Earl to Mr. Monroe's attention, and he was kind of like, I don't know, I'm not sure if I'm ready for banjo. And they were saying, you need to hear this kid. You need to hear this 21-year-old kid. He plays differently. And so they had kind of an informal audition, And Monroe, Earl said that Monroe never said, you got the job. He just said, okay, we leave on Monday.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened when I auditioned for the job.
Right.
He just said,
really?
Okay, we're leaving tonight at 3 a.m.
Oh, my gosh.
And Earl had to go back and kind of check with Lost John and with other people to make sure he could actually do this job. He didn't know how much it paid or anything, but it's probably good that he didn't know how much it paid at the time. He wound up taking the job. And as soon as they went on the road that first week, and when they got back to Nashville to play the Opry, that was when the world heard, because that WSM radio signal was huge. Then it was nearly like a satellite radio kind of thing is now. It could be heard way up into the Northeast and down to Texas. And
back in those days, they could boost the signal a lot more than they're allowed to nowadays.
That's right. And so what people heard, they thought they were going to hear the Bill Monroe that they had enjoyed all those other weeks on the Opry, but then they heard this sound. They didn't know what it looked like. They didn't know what he was doing. People sat there going, what is that sound? Is that a banjo? And how on earth is he making that sound with that instrument? And so many people who had banjos, they just started trying to figure it out on their own. They didn't have the visuals for it. It was a remarkable moment, that moment in December 1945 when Earl played on the Opry for the first time with Mr. Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys band. And that was really the that lineup of the band and those sounds that were made. People considered that to be traditional bluegrass sound. Of course, there's a tradition that only goes back to 1945, but there's so many bands right now whose sole goal is just to replicate the sounds that came off that Ryman Auditorium stage on the Opry in December of 45. That was that, and it cemented in Mr. Monroe's mind through Earl's hands, they were able to cement what had been in Mr. Monroe's mind, and that was bluegrass. So bluegrass, though it's people talk about the ancient tones and the traditions of bluegrass, our ancient tones really go back to 1945.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about how Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs met and when they decided to become a duo.
Bob, would you like to handle that?
Okay. Well, you probably know more about it than I do, but I do know that they were both in Bill Monroe's band, and they were both bluegrass boys, and they essentially left at the same time, I believe, and formed their own band somewhere, I believe, in 1948.
Yes, it was just a couple of years after they had joined. They were each members of that band, and Mr. Monroe, hopefully by the time Bob joined up, Mr. Monroe was paying a little better, but
No, I wouldn't say that.
I've read your book. A great book, by the way. Come Hither to Go Yonder, Playing Bluegrass with Bill Monroe. That's it's a book that any fan of the music should read. But they kind of got to talking and thought, well, we're not getting paid much here. We could do this ourselves. And it was a bitter blow to Mr. Monroe, and they didn't speak for years and years. Monroe wouldn't even
20 years, I read. 20 years.
That's right.
I understand. Neither Lester Flatt nor Earl.
Yes.
He didn't speak. And I understand that for a while he didn't use any banjo after Earl left. Was he playing without any banjo?
Really?
He went for a bit, but then he had others that came in and that had been fascinated with Scruggs sound and that were able to bring different things into the band. He always had a great banjo player. But Flatt and Scruggs became, while Mr. Monroe is rightly credited as the father of bluegrass music, Flatt and Scruggs' popularity greatly eclipsed Mr. Monroe's in the, certainly in the 1960s. And they were in people's living rooms, of course, through the Beverly Hillbillies show, and they were in the folk boom, because in 1959, Earl had traveled up to the Newport Folk Festival. Lester wouldn't go because he thought there were too many long hairs there. And Earl played and pulled that party trick out and delighted everyone there and told Lester about it and how they all wanted records. And so Lester was okay with going the year after that.
Right.
Suddenly the banjo was in the three-finger style was part of the folk boom So they had the phone booth going, and then they had the TV thing going, and they were hot.
Yeah, let's hear a little bit of Flatt and Scruggs, and we're welcoming phone calls too. We want to invite the audience. 800-486-8655 is our number. We're paying tribute to Earl Scruggs this hour of the program. This is Cripple Creek. We'll start taking some of your phone calls as well. Our number is 800-486-8655. Peter Cooper, senior music writer for the Daily Tennessean, a Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter. He was at the memorial service for Earl Scruggs this past Sunday. Bob Black, bluegrass musician and banjo player. He toured with Bill Monroe and is the author of Come Hither to Go Yonder, playing bluegrass with Bill Monroe. To your calls, more music, more conversation ahead on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Foggy Mountain Breakdown, perhaps one of their most famous songs. I'm sure when you heard me play that just a moment ago, you thought, I know that song. What was the origins of that song? And it was a huge hit. At least I've heard it many, many times. Was it a huge hit, Peter?
Well, they didn't have much in the way of big country chart hits. It was a huge hit in the bluegrass world, and it's something that just about everybody who picks up a banjo now learns to play.
Mm.
But I believe that the theme from the Beverly Hillbillies was their only number one country hit as the charts went.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but the origins are those Foggy Mountains where that Earl was near in Shelby, North Carolina, and he would just sit and pick and come up with something that he fancied that delighted him and turn it into a song. So a lot of banjo players now say they sit and pick and they're trying to write a song, but they just wind up writing Foggy Mountain Breakdown again.
How hard is it to play that song, Bob?
Well, that first lick in there that you hear is actually, I always had a hard time, for a long time I had a hard time learning that lick. But one point I wanted to make was that Bill Monroe's tune, Bluegrass Breakdown, Earl had been playing that tune with Bill, and that's a real similar sounding tune, and just goes to a different chord change instead of going to the E minor, that first chord change. When Bill played Bluegrass back then, I went to F, but it's essentially the same tune. And so I think Earl was playing the same lick at the start of that tune that he put into Foggy Mountain Breakdown, and Bill Monroe even said that many times. He said, well, he wrote that off of Bluegrass Breakdown.
that didn't bother Bill any, did it?
I don't believe it did.
Really?
It did.
Let's go to Chuck in Lake Delton, one of our listeners. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, you?
Good, thanks. I picked up a Baldwin banjo, five-string banjo, about 40 years ago. Earl's book about how to play with the three-finger style. And in the book, it said that him and his sister would start off back-to-back at the house and start playing and see if they could keep in time by the time they met coming around the opposite side of the house.
That's right.
And I thought that was pretty interesting to see if they could keep their rhythm. And, you know, you played Cripple Creek. That's one of the first tunes you kind of learned on the three-finger style.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's got all the stuff in it. You know, I don't read music, but I read tablature. And he kind of instructed us on how to play tablature.
Uh-huh.
That's right.
For years,
those instructional books were...
The first tune I would teach when I was teaching students, the first tune would be Cripple Creek. Because
really?
It has all the basic moves. It's got a slide and a hammer on and a pull off and et cetera.
Yeah. He did write the... He literally wrote the book, and his instructional books were big sellers, and they sold them out of the house, the home offices over on Donna Drive in near Nashville. And he also would sell picks and capos and things like that. I keep hearing stories from people who called up, and Earl would pick the phone up, or Louise, his wife, would pick the phone up and hand it to Earl if somebody was asking something technical. It was definitely not a... the bluegrass world, such as it was, it was not this world of like Alison Krauss now with tour buses and, you know, packed 3,000 seat venues. It was a little bit hard scrabble, even when things were going well.
Thank you, Chuck, so much for your call. Virginia in Milwaukee. Hi, Virginia.
Good morning again. I had just called yesterday, Kathleen, but good morning to you all. Really glad to hear this program. Something else dear to my heart, just as yesterday. I had run into Lester Flatt probably, I'd say, around 15 years ago, right in that area, right over here on the east side of Milwaukee at Shank Hall. Now, I saw that his bus was parked right outside, and I thought, well, I guess I'll just wait out here and see if I can shake that man's hand, because I used to listen to him many years ago.
Sure.
Right here in Milwaukee, him and Earl. So, of course, he came out all by himself, and I was able to shake his hand and tell him that I listened to him years ago. And this man was just as down to earth and just a regular country gentleman. He had the suit, the tie, the whole thing, and he just went in and got on his bus. There was no big deal whatsoever, and I was just so glad to be able to shake his hand.
Yeah.
Because I know that Earl was the best five-string banjo player in the world.
That's right.
Peter.
That's right, yeah. And you said Lester Flatt at first, and of course Lester died a long time ago in 79. You're speaking of Earl Scruggs. And yes, he was... absolutely gentle guy. Shank Hall in Milwaukee is not a traditional bluegrass venue, by the way. They have a lot of rock there, and Earl was always comfortable in whatever environment. He would play the Troubadour in Los Angeles. He would play folk venues, and he expanded his music as well. He loved picking with Ravi Shankar. He always talked about playing with the saxophone player King Curtis backstage and how much he loved that. So while a lot of people in bluegrass music will tend to play only bluegrass venues and often are, as we said, working to try to replicate what Earl did in 1945, Earl was looking at expansion. He was very broad-minded in terms of song choice and choice of where to play and who to play with, and yes, when he would he loved meeting people and was he was described as shy sometimes, and I'm not sure that that's right exactly. He was very friendly. He was not going to bubble over with the words, but he was I think he was more considered than he was shy. So that's, I'm so glad you had that great experience meeting Earl Scruggs. This was a guy who, a monument of a guy that you could actually interact with.
Thank you, Virginia, very much for the call. You mentioned the theme from the Beverly Hillbillies being their best-known piece. I wanted to play a little bit of an interview and have you comment on it, and then we'll play a little bit of that song, because this is how the it's Earl talking about how the deal came about with Beverly Hillbillies, and it is absolutely charming.
When we first contacted the Beverly Hillbillies, Louise, my wife, turned it down because she just wasn't sure how people in California might portray Tennessee people. She didn't mind us being hillbillies, but it's to be respected, you know. She wouldn't consent to it, so they flew the stage manager and a pilot, Fem, here to Nashville and had a showing room somewhere here in Nashville, and we went up and saw the show, and they showed us where they was going to be real hillbillies, but they'd be intelligent type, just common sense intelligent, you know. So they convinced us that it wouldn't be degrading. It'd be hillbillies for sure, but it'd be smart, intelligent people. So
I just love that answer. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, I spoke with him about that, and with his wife Louise, who was a groundbreaking person in her own right. She was the first female manager and booker in Nashville, and kind of infiltrated the good old boys network. But she wasn't having any of it, the folks from CBS called and said, "Hey, we got good news. We want Flatt and Scruggs to do the theme song." And she just said no. And well, I'm sorry, ma'am, you must not understand. This is, you know, and what a big deal that was back then. Of course, this is before satellite dishes and cable and all that. You've just got a few networks, and they were going to feature Flatt and Scruggs, put them in everybody's living room. And she turned them down flat, and they said, "Well, why?" And she said, "Don't like the word hillbillies. I was called that when I was a child, and it was not meant in a positive way."
Yes,
and so they
yes.
did. Now I guess you could send it through you send it link on the via the web, but at the time that meant a couple of plane tickets and carrying the physical film, you know, from L.A. to Nashville, arranging a private showing for Louise and Earl before they would sign off on CBS putting them into everyone's living room and bringing bluegrass music to a truly national stage in that way. They had to be convinced at the expense of CBS before they would go for that.
Isn't that a wonderful story? And the way that he talks about it, he's just so matter-of-fact and kind about it, and he gets to the point. It's just charming, and it's so honest, isn't it? He's just so honest.
Honest and charming, absolutely.
Yeah.
That reminds me of Bill Monroe, was always concerned about the hillbilly image, and that's why he always wore a suit and tie everywhere that he played. And he always said, "I was the first man on the Grand Ole Opry to wear a suit and tie." He always used to say that. And I think that was to avoid that hillbilly image. I think he was conscious of that as well.
Yeah. Matthew in Warren, Illinois. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Uh-huh.
I heard this music when I was a child and said to my mom, "Hey, I'd like to learn how to play the banjo," and ended up, although not starting that young, about 25 years ago, started playing and at the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago.
Sure.
And a number of years later, went back and learned more of the bluegrass style. The trouble is that even though Earl Scruggs made it for banjo players, he also made it very hard on banjo players. So the first thing everyone asks you when you come out, I'm taking banjo class, so can you play the theme to Beverly Hillbillies? It's like asking someone in a, you know, violin class and just pick up the violin, "Can you play Paganini?"
give a six-year-old a basketball and go, "Can you dunk like Jordan?"
Well, that's a tall order. I'll bet that happens to a lot of banjo players, Bob, does it?
Oh, yeah. We get requests for the theme from the Beverly Hillbillies all the time, And I don't mind doing it. And I even sing a verse to it of that was on a commercial verse about Winston cigarettes. I even sing that verse when I do it. But and people always request that, and they always request Foggy Mountain Breakdown, and we don't mind doing it. The Foggy Mountain Breakdown is a great tune, and I love playing it. So.
Yeah, it is a great tune. Well, we got to play a little bit now that we've talked about it so darn much. We got to play a little bit of the Beverly Hillbillies.
Come and listen to my story about a man named Jed. Poor mountaineer, barely kept his family fed. And then one day he was shooting at some food, and up through the ground come a bubbling crude. Oil, that is, black gold, Texas tea. First thing you know, old Jed's a millionaire. Kinfolk said, Jed, move away from there. He said, California is the place you ought to be. So he loaded up the truck and they moved to Beverly Hills, that is, swimming pools, movie stars. Say goodbye to Jed and all his kin. They would like to thank you folks for kindly dropping in. You're all invited back again to this locality to have a heaping helping of their hospitality. Beverly Hillbillies, that's what they call them now. Nice folks. You all come back here.
Oh, I love it. Y'all come back now, you hear? Peter Cooper, a senior music writer for the Daily Tennessean, a Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter, and Bob Black, bluegrass musician and banjo player, who toured with Bill Monroe and is the author of Come Hither to Go Yonder, Playing Bluegrass with Bill Monroe. And they are our guests as we remember the life of Earl Scruggs, who died last week. Memorial service was on Sunday. Tell us a little more about that memorial service, Peter. It sounds like it was magnificent.
Yeah, it was. It was really beautiful. It was, you know, Earl had played with thousands and thousands of people. You could actually pick with Earl, and so they really, there were a lot of people who knew him. You know, through the festival scene of the '60s, he could be out in a parking lot playing with 60 folks just jamming on Flat and Scruggs tunes, or you know, he was very open about having folks over at his house. So this was he was not a distant figure, and so there was a real warmth to the memorial service because it was packed with people who actually knew him. I noticed that after he passed on Facebook, people started posting not just video clips of Flat and Scruggs or anything like that. They were posting pictures of themselves with Earl. He was a very accessible legend. And so there was a real warmth to the room because of that. And, of course, there were grand performances from Emmylou Harris and Vince Gill, Bella Fleck, John McEwen of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Earl was really the guy who showed them the way towards their Will the Circle Be Unbroken album. He did a great performance. A lot of folks talking about Earl and honoring him with his songs. And they had banjo players on the aisles. And as the casket passed, the banjo players would their banjos were silent, but they had the necks raised as the necks of the banjos raised as the casket passed and went out of the Ryman, and then they would lower the necks of the banjo as it once it was past them. It was a really moving memorial.
Oh, it sounds like it was really moving. And what about all these accolades that he was the best, he will always be the best, nobody can ever play like that again? Bob, do you think that's true?
Well, yeah, it's definitely true that nobody will ever play like Earl. He had his own touch and his own attack
of the strings. It seemed like there was a mile of space around every note, or that's just the illusion that it had, because every note really stood out. And it's true that no one will ever play like Earl, and some of those old recordings, you listen to the tone of that banjo, and it's just that's the kind of tone everybody tries to get on their banjos, and some get close to it, but he was unique in his tone. I wish I could have made it down to the memorial service. I had a friend down there. His name is Randy Escobedo. He was there, and he told me about he was on the aisle. Well, he's a banjo player, and he was one of those banjo players standing in the aisle, and he was telling me about that. And I've never seen something. And one other thing he told me about was when they took the they went out to the cemetery, and somebody brought out a banjo case. And they opened the lid to the banjo case, and two white doves flew out of it.
Oh, my goodness.
And that was really, I never heard of that being done before. But Randy told me about that, too. So.
Wow.
Let's go to Rusty in Coon Valley. Hi, Rusty.
Oh, Kathleen, thanks for having me on. I have a comment and a question. One of my comments was a quote from John Cohen of Newgrass Revival. He had talked about the new sound, a lot of the artists were not supporting that and didn't like the direction that bluegrass is going when they started. But there were three people that really did support the new grass revival revolution, and one of those was Earl Scruggs.
Yes.
Also, Vassar Clements and Doc Watson. And my question is actually for Bob, who I have met, and I do have a copy of his book, what he thinks of the direction that some of these banjo pickers are going, like Jamie Stone and Bela Fleck.
I've always really loved what Bela Fleck does, and I wish I could do it. A lot of people did not like Newgrass Revival when they first started coming out with their stuff. I did like them quite a bit, and I do remember Earl Scruggs review. When he was playing with his three sons, Gary, Randy, and Steve. Steve is dead now, I guess. I remember going to one of their concerts, and they were heavily rock and roll oriented. They had drums, and I think Vassar was playing with them too.
Yeah.
And I was playing a show with Buck White and the Down Home Folks back then, and the Earl Scruggs Review were the headliners, I guess. And I remember watching them come out, and about half of the audience got up and walked out because they were so against what Earl was doing then.
Oh, my.
And so I think most, that would never happen now. But at the time, they really hated it that Earl broke up with Lester Flatt and went with this rock and roll thing. But, that also makes me think about the concept of transcending the genre, his banjo playing. He allowed the banjo, or he made it possible for the banjo to be heard in other type musical venues other than just the strict bluegrass venue. So that's one. Another thing that Earl really did to help the banjo. So, but in response to the question, I love what these new banjo players are doing, such as Bela Fleck, and I just wish I could do it myself. I do play some melodic, chromatic kind of stuff, but it's different. What I do does not sound like Bela Fleck, that's for sure.
Thanks, Rusty, very much for the call. More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the life of Earl Scruggs, and quite a life it was. This hour of the program, we have two guests, Bob Black, bluegrass musician, banjo player himself, toured with Bill Monroe, and is the author of Come Hither to Go Yonder, Playing Bluegrass with Bill Monroe. Peter Cooper is also with us, senior music writer for the Daily Tennessean and a Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter. For those of you who are particularly fond of Earl Scruggs, have been inspired by his life and his music, Peter has written beautifully about his memorial service and about his life in the Daily Tennessean. You can look it up, I'm sure, online. More phone calls momentarily, and more music as well here on the Ideas Network. Oh, don't know about you, but I could just sit here and listen to this all day long. We have to ask what it is about this music that makes us, really enters us, makes us want to dance, want to pretend like we're playing the banjo. Peter Cooper is with us, senior music writer for the Daily Tennessean and a Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter. Bob Black, bluegrass musician, banjo player who toured with Bill Monroe and is the author of Playing Bluegrass with Bill Monroe. What is it about this music? What is it that just kind of gets us? We stand up and immediately start tapping our toes. I don't do that with other kinds of music.
I don't know. It's got an intense drive to it, I guess, and it energizes you. You get up and you hear it, and it's good music to listen to when you're driving a long
yes.
way. You can stay awake for miles and miles. And miles.
All right, I'll remember that. Colin in Milwaukee. Hi, Colin.
Hello there.
Hi.
It's a pleasure to be on your program, and thank you for doing this tribute to Earl.
Our pleasure.
And I'd like to share, I was at the funeral at the Ryman a couple days ago, and would like to share a short story that I think one of the things Bela pointed out in his short speech there after playing a wonderful piece on the banjo was Earl's amazing sense of humor. He was very incisive when he played, and he was also very incisive when he spoke. And he was wasn't a loud talker. He was a thoughtful. He always thought before he spoke, and once in a while he would just drop the funniest things. And Bela did share a story when Bela was driving in Nashville, and he was driving far too fast. He got pulled over, and a police officer came up to Bela's car and, went through the process there and got Bela's license, and he came back to Bela's car, and Bela thought he was about to get a ticket, and the cop looked down at Bela, and he asked him a question. He said, "Oh, who's the best banjo player in the world?" And without dropping a beat, Bela gave the police officer his honest answer, and he looked at him, and he said, "Well, Earl Scruggs." And the police officer looked back down and gave Bela's license back to him and said, "Watch your speed."
It's a great story.
One of many things Earl did for so many people, and it was a real honor to be at the service. It was a real fitting tribute, and it was essentially a funeral concert. They had Emmylou Harris and Del McCurry and Bela Fleck and John McEwen and Ricky Skaggs.
Oh, my.
And it was just a real honor to be there.
Colin, are you a musician, Colin? How did you happen to be there?
Yeah, I am a musician, and I've recently relocated to Nashville from Milwaukee. I made a recording down there in October with some real good friends of Earl, actually. A gentleman named Larry Perkins produced the record, and Larry and Earl were like father and son. And so I was able to attend the funeral because I was there at the time. I'm back in Milwaukee now for about a week, and I'm transitioning down to Nashville to release the record that I made there.
What do you play?
What
do you play?
Oh, I play banjo. I play guitar. I play fiddle, and I also do some footwork in the percussive footwork in the spirit of another good friend of Earl's named John Hartford. Mm-hmm. And, John Hartford and Earl were dear, dear friends. And that's what I do.
Mm. And what's your full name, Colin?
Colin O'Brien.
Oh, Colin O'Brien.
Yeah, right. Yeah, German.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I look forward to hearing that, Colin.
Yes.
You're name checking all my heroes.
And I'm talking to Bob now, or?
Oh, this is Peter, but you're going to talk to Bob because, Kathleen, I actually have to run and go teach a course
you do?
At Vanderbilt University, and this has been a pleasure. And thank you so much for having me on and for talking with folks about Earl Scruggs.
Oh, Peter, thank you. Have a good class, and thanks for all your writing about him too. It's you've written some beautiful pieces over the last. Well, I just discovered you in the last few days, but I'm sure you've written a lot of beautiful pieces. The pieces about Scruggs are very moving.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much. Okay.
Yeah, thank you so much for the call. And Colin, if you want to. You know, I don't know how you do this. Send us some of your music, or we'd love to hear you. Whoops, Colin is gone. Colin O'Brien, thank you. We'd like very much to hear. Bob, did we leave a question there?
I don't know. I would like to hear his Colin's recording as well.
I would too.
Maybe he'll mail you email you a some MP3s that would play on the air.
All right, let's do that. Let's ask Colin for you to do that for us so that we can get your music to the people who have been with us this hour too. That would be great. And we also want to remind you, Rhonda, I've been touting the words of Peter Cooper. Go to our Facebook page too, because the piece that he wrote about Earl Scruggs, the memorial service, is on our Facebook page, and it's a lovely read. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show at Facebook. And tell me, Bob, in the minutes that we have left here, what is it about this kind of music that attracted you, that made you decide that you were going to devote your life to playing bluegrass?
Well, I first heard it back in the 1960s when I was going to high school, and I didn't really figure I was going to devote my life to it. There wasn't that much of it going on around Des Moines, Iowa, which is where I was growing up.
Oh.
But the first album I ever bought was Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs' Foggy Mountain Jamboree album, and that really got me going. And I started learning banjo and found out that it came pretty easily for me, and so I just kind of got addicted to it, and spent many hours sitting around playing and practicing and driving my family crazy with it. So I don't know, I just kind of, I never came to a decision suddenly that this is what I want to do. It was just like I just started doing it, and then I couldn't stop, you know. It's kind of like becoming addicted to a drug or something. You don't really intend, not a person that becomes a drug addict would not intentionally start out thinking, oh, I'm going to start doing this drug all the time. You know, well, that's the way it was with me. It just kind of happened, you know, and I just couldn't stop. I couldn't stop it. So.
You couldn't stop it. Yeah. Well, there are worse things. And how hard was it when you talk about auditioning for Bill Monroe and his saying, all right, 3 a.m, we're on the road. How hard a life was it for you?
Yeah. Oh, traveling with Bill was extremely rewarding, but at the same time, extremely fatiguing for me. I lasted for about 2 years in there before I finally started becoming so exhausted that I was actually having health problems.
Oh.
He was a very inspiring person and to be around, and that's why I ended up writing this book about him, because I had so many great feelings and great thoughts about Bill, and most of them were real positive thoughts too. But he did expect a lot from his, and so we really worked hard, and we really drove many miles.
Yeah, thank you, Bob, so much for being with us. It was a wonderful hour. Thank you, Bob Black, and his book is "Come Hither to Go Yonder: Playing Bluegrass with Bill Monroe." Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this terrific hour. I had such a good time. I hope you did too.